Hello friends, welcome to the show. I'm Tom Brobeck and my guest today is Mike Boyle. Mike agreed to come back on the podcast to talk about a variety of topics, including personal finance, which I did not expect, but certainly enjoyed and appreciated. In this episode, you'll learn what traits have led to the success Mike experienced as a coach and business owner. I can never thank him enough for spending time with me recording an episode like this. Make sure you follow him on social media and share this episode with your fellow coaches and therapists. Thanks for coming back on the podcast. I appreciate it. It's always fun to get an audience with you and to get a one-on-one conversation. It's just, you know, 5 years ago, it's unfathomable that I'd be talking to you over the internet. And now we can set it up in a matter of weeks. And it's a really easy thing to do. So I appreciate you taking time to chat with me again.
No problem.
I love doing these. Perfect. On some recent podcasts, you've talked about the longevity of your career, the things that you've seen, the things that you've experienced. And at some point, your career is going to end. So it made me thinking of asking you, why did you originally want to be a strength coach?
That's a really good question. Why did I originally want to be a strength coach? I think there was like almost an adventure there, because now if you think about this, there was really no such thing at the time growing up. So that I had coaches, I knew I didn't like the idea of coaching a particular sport. For whatever reason, that didn't appeal to me. And the reason I went into athletic training is that I thought athletic training would give me some sort of way, I guess, to be involved in sport, but not have to coach a singular individual sport. And then suddenly strength and conditioning was this wonderful opportunity that combined all these things that I liked. I loved training. I was probably a training nerd long before they were training nerds, in terms of I was reading books about working out, and I had the York 110-pound weight set in my basement and the wall chart on the wall. And I was doing lots of things that were involved in the idea of getting better at sports. There's a little construction going on in my house. So I'm going to close that door. I was fascinated with the process of getting better, probably because I wasn't very good. I think one of the great commonalities with most of the strength coaches that I know is that they weren't particularly overwhelmingly talented. I think most of them were relatively average athletes who realized that there was some ability to make yourself better. And I get into that process and think about that. I mean, you're talking about someone, it was the very early 1970s. When I probably started training, it was probably 1973 or four that I actually started to weight train and started to run and run sprints and do all of these things. So I guess in a lot of ways, it seemed like the perfect opportunity. It was almost like it was made for me.
A lot of strength coaches that I know too had a significant injury either in their playing career or at some time in their life, and they had to use a combination of rehab and training to get either back to where they were or ahead of where they wanted to be. Did you ever have any significant injuries in your career that you had to attack that way?
Yeah, and that was what actually drew me more to athletic training, to be honest, than to strength and conditioning, because we had what at that time they called a grandfather clause athletic trainer. So grandfather clause athletic trainers were basically people who learned to take care of injuries, but had really no formal training. We had a guy, Mr. Driscoll was his name, and he's probably long since passed on because I remember him being old in high school, but he could evaluate injuries and tape. And I hurt my knee in high school, my senior year of football, and he kind of kept me playing. He would tape my knee up every day, and I had probably torn my medial collateral. And I think probably in retrospect, probably had torn or partially torn my ACL. But at that time, the diagnostics were not nearly what they were in this day and age. And that drew me towards the athletic training side. And I think I went to school with the idea that I wanted to help people like me who had gotten hurt. And then I think strength and conditioning came along and I realized, wow, I probably have a way more powerful way to do what I thought it was I wanted to do in the beginning. But the good part about that was that my education ended up being much better. I think everybody should have to study more like they're trying to be an athletic trainer or more like they're trying to be a physical therapist when they want to be a strength and conditioning coach. Because I think there's a number of great failings, but one of the great failings is you get strength and conditioning coaches who are effectively just meatheads. They're just guys that like the weight room and they don't really understand anatomy and they don't even really understand training. Their knowledge of training is limited to sort of parroting what they read on the internet about West Side or whatever it is. So I think a better education probably would help us in general as a field.
I agree with that. And on the flip side, I think a lot of physical therapists should have some experience in strength and conditioning to understand how to load patients, how to progress them, how to regress them, and get some of that knowledge in a kind of weight room, gym type setting. Because too often you hear these stories of athletes going to PT and they never pick up a dumbbell heavier than 10 pounds. They're never doing anything on their feet. Everything's on the table. So I think both fields would benefit immensely from each other in that respect.
Yes, I would 100% agree. And I hate to badmouth your field, but you're 100% right. I think your field is worse than strength and conditioning in terms of, I think there are far fewer good physical therapists than there are good strength and conditioning coaches. Good physical therapy is extremely, extremely hard to find. And particularly in the orthopedic world, which is the only world that I'm in probably and that you're in, and to find people who understand, as you said, the process of loading and understand athletes and understand rehab is extremely difficult. And as a result for us, we tend to do a lot of our rehab ourselves, which actually we do reconditioning ourselves, because I got in trouble once for saying that we did rehab. Some physical therapists like you wrote nasty letters saying that we can't do rehabilitation because we are not qualified. So
I would never write you a nasty letter. I guarantee that. But
no, it is interesting that I said to somebody, I've gone to physical therapy schools and taught classes, and yet somehow as an athletic trainer or as a strength coach, I'm not qualified to rehabilitate an athlete. But it's a classic example of terminology and semantics and how people get really territorial. But it's interesting. I think I've only had 3 PT students or 4 PT students who actually came and worked with me for any substantial time in the weight room. And those people ended up, one is performance director for the New Jersey Devils. One is medical director for the Oklahoma City Thunder. One was medical director at Stanford. And I'd have to think about where the fourth one ended up. But it was really interesting that those physical therapy students who were smart enough to say, I need to get in a weight room with a good strength coach and understand strength and conditioning, have generally gone really far in the field. And the average kid who goes and does their clinical hours and then has no clue is destined to wallow in mediocrity, I guess.
Well, it's a disservice to the athletes too, or the clients that you're patients, whatever word you want to use, that if you're trying to get them back to sport and you don't know all the steps to get there, you don't know what that end stage rehab is going to look like because you don't know how to load them, how to progress them, what qualities they need to work on. It's really a disservice to the athlete because you're not preparing them for what's coming. So the more you can kind of blend those two fields, I think it's just a huge advantage to these athletes. And the reason we have to do this is because injury rates are not what we want them to be. If the standard was, all right, everyone from ACL surgery got back and never retore, then we won't have to push as hard. But the injury rates are terrible and we need to get better. And working together seems like a much better approach than trying to do everything on our own.
Without a doubt, I 100% agree. It's really interesting how, as you said, injury rates, re-tear rates, all that stuff tells us that we're not doing a really good job. And in all honesty, the problem, the fault lies in the schools when you realize, and I get it because one of the things when people tell me they want to apply to physical therapy school, one of the things I tell them is don't talk about sports, don't talk about orthopedics, because a lot of times you won't get in, because the biggest problem is that there's so many physical therapists who want to be in the sports orthopedic world, and there aren't enough physical therapists who want to be in all these other essential areas of physical therapy that need physical therapists. But the result is a very as with most education, a very broad generalist sort of education. And then that person who wants to really work in sports and in orthopedics comes out kind of woefully unprepared. And what do? They revert back to maybe what they either what they learned during their clinical or what they knew themselves as an athlete or as their, you know, in their college program or whatever it was. So it's not a perfect system by any stretch of the imagination.
Not at all, but hopefully improves in the coming years. As you went, going back to kind of your why and throughout your career, as you went through the years and the decades, did your why for coaching ever change? Did it ever become different than what you initially started with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, initially, I wanted to wear the jersey and get a national championship ring. And I think everything that every young strength coach wants. And then over time, I think when you go through the process and you win a championship and you get to wear the jersey and you get some recognition, and then you start to realize that, okay, kind of what next? No big deal kind of thing. And you progress. That's why I always say to people, and I've said this on a bunch of podcasts, the one advantage that I have over everybody or over most everybody is 40 years of experience. And I think it's really easy in the beginning to get caught up chasing the jersey and chasing the rings and all these things. And I don't know if you ever saw my Perform Better keynote speech, but I talk about the fact that my rings are, they're in a box, in a drawer. I probably couldn't immediately isolate where they are right now. If you said to me, go run and get a World Series ring and bring it here, I'd be like, if you got a couple of minutes, I have some ideas where it might be, but I don't really know, in all honesty, where it is. I don't. I have two national championship rings and a World Series ring, and they sit in a box. And so that shows you that those things eventually will be less significant. And what you realize, if you've ever read Inside Out Coaching, Joe Ehrman talks about the idea of the 10-year window or the 20-year window. And it's when those kids come back and tell you the impact that you had on their life, not on their sporting career, that you really start to understand what the why is and what you're actually trying to get accomplished during this process. And I think that most people don't get it. And I get that they don't get it, because when you're 21 or 22 years old and you think, wow, I'm going to get to run out onto the field with the football team at whatever stadium, and I'm going to hear the crowd, and that's a big deal. But you will realize at some point down the line that it's not nearly as big a deal as you thought it was. And that ultimately at the end of it all, no one really gives a shit in terms of, like I said, I used to always laugh. My son, who's now getting older, he's 16 years old, but when he was a kid, when I was working for the Red Sox, people would ask him what I did and they'd be like, he's a coacher. And I was like, yeah, I'm a coacher. Yeah, that's kind of what I do. And I remember taking him to Fenway. And now I'm taking him to Fenway Park and saying that we can play on the field. We can go outside. We can go out to Fenway Park and play catch on the grass. And there's going to be players there. And he's like, yeah. And he comes once. And it's literally, he's with Jacoby Ellsbury, Carl Crawford, me, and my son. My son plays catch for a couple of minutes, and then he wants to go in and play with the video games that are inside in the locker room. And then the next week I ask him to come back again. He's like, no, I'm good. I want to play with my friends. And you just think, okay, all this stuff is so, so irrelevant in the big picture. And there's other things that are really going to matter. And you got to focus on those things.
I think one of the challenges in strength conditioning are there's so few role models that have survived countless years in the profession. I don't know the average career of an SNC coach, but it has to be pretty low. And I found this out with physical therapy too. I had a mentor tell me that the average physical therapy career was 8 years because of burnout, because of injuries, because of maternity leave. So it's hard to know where you want to go in the field if you don't have a lot of role models who have survived 10, 20, 30 plus years coaching. So if someone's never heard of Mike Boyle and never been out to your facility, it's hard to know what does this longevity look like. Do you have any advice for coaches who want to have a long-term impact on the field?
I think if you want to have a long-term impact on the field, realize that you want to have a long-term impact on people, because ultimately that's what it will be about, and that it will not be about the number of championships. And, you know, I think I'm just repeating myself in some way, because it won't be about who you work for or what school you work for. Eventually all of that stuff will not matter. So don't chase that. I think I would say enjoy that, but try to find, I got great advice from a guy named Bill Urbanek, who was a football coach at Wake Forest, probably in the, I'm trying to think, in college. So this would have been early 80s. And we were sitting talking, and he said, "Mike, it's not about jobs, it's about situations." Because I asked him about why he was still at Wake Forest, and he said, "I have a great situation at Wake Forest." And I remember thinking, "Wow, it's not about jobs, it's about situations." And I think that's why I stayed at Boston University so long, because I had a great situation at Boston University. I could have taken any number of pro jobs. There were so many things I didn't do during the time I was at Boston University. And now I look back and think, wow, I'm so glad I didn't do any of those things, because my life would have been so drastically different. My kids would have grown up in a different place around different people, because I think some people make gypsies out of their wives and out of their children as they continue to whether they're chasing money or they're chasing status or they're chasing rings, but they're chasing something, as opposed to looking and thinking, it's okay to settle down. It's okay to find a place that you like and stay there. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no shame. I can remember, and I used to not name names, but I don't really care anymore. A guy named Chris Palmer, who was our football coach at Boston University, and eventually went on, I think, to become the head football coach of the Browns. Not one of my favorite guys by any stretch of the imagination, but he told me once that I wouldn't amount to anything, that I wasn't motivated because I didn't want to leave Boston University. And he had been, during the time he had come from, he had been in the New Jersey Generals, the USFL, then he was at University of New Haven, then he was at BU. He left BU to go someplace else, left someplace else to go to the NFL. But he referred to me as unmotivated because I liked coaching at BU at that time. And I thought, I'm not really unmotivated. I think I'm just differently motivated. That's how I felt in my mind. But his thing was that if I didn't want to be an NFL strength coach, or if I didn't want to follow him to wherever the next job was, that there was something wrong with me. And I think you have to look at that and realize that there's nothing wrong with you when you're not changing jobs every 2 years. And I find people, even now, some of the young kids that I deal with, they're constantly chasing the next thing. Like, what's the next thing? Where's the next job? As opposed to looking at it and thinking about that, again, that situation idea. Do I have a situation that's good for me? Do I have a situation that's good for my family? Am I working with people that I like? There's so much more to job satisfaction than money or jersey name, but I think it takes a while for people to realize that.
Too often we treat jobs like a pyramid, and there's one job at the top that's superior to all the others, and you have to work your way up. And it's really flipped on its side, and there's silos, and you got to find what's the best fit for you. And as a young coach or as a kid, you don't understand, like, what is fit? Like, how does my family, how do my finances, where do I want to live? Do I want to work 80 plus hour weeks? Those kinds of things. But it seems like you've identified that at BU, you had the right fit. And I think now with social media, it matters even less where you work. You can still have a huge impact on the world through writing, through speaking, through podcasts, through lectures, through connecting with other coaches. So it seems like you've nailed that fit piece down for the majority of your career.
I think so. And I think I've established for a lot of people maybe what that fit piece is. And I hope I do end up being a good example for people of the fact that you don't have to chase around to be successful. You just need to be good at what you do. I think that's ultimately, you need to be good at the craft. And I think some people get, it's an old John Wooden quote, and it's I think, you know, if you're constantly trying to learn the tricks of the trade, maybe you never learn the trade. And I think that's what happens, is some people are so busy trying to politic their way into their next job that maybe they're not really good at the job that they're at, and yet they can still politic their way into the next job. If you hang around with the right guys and you drink a few beers and you slap a few backs, you maybe get to go along for the ride, which I think is what's happened with a lot of guys. The other thing, and I want to go back a step, when you said there aren't that many people, there aren't that many older strength coaches, you have to remember that I am the first generation. I came in with first group of people who were becoming employed as strength and conditioning coaches. So the And I'm a little bit younger, say, than the Alvin Mealls or the Johnny Parkers or some of those guys, but I'm not that much younger. I'm maybe, I guess I might be 8 or 10 years younger than those guys. But most of those guys, actually, I think all of those guys were initially regular coaches, were sport coaches first, and then eventually realized that maybe they liked this strength and conditioning process, and they sort of fell into the strength and conditioning coach role. And then in many ways, they created that role for the rest of us.
It's a common theme throughout your career that you're kind of an early adopter, whether it's the actual field itself, your blog, the podcast that you do, your training philosophies. Have you noticed that trend throughout your career?
Absolutely. I have always, you're 100% right. I have been an early adopter. I have been very good at recognizing where things are going and then trying to go there. Even opening a private business, I remember thinking, I talked to people about the idea of opening a training center, and I got advice from lots of coaches saying, man, just stay at BU. You got a good job. Like, why are you going to leave? Why are you going to take off and take all this risk? And I always think, wow, I think I've done really well a lot of times by not listening to advice and just kind of going with my gut. I remember thinking, wow, I don't want to be the guy who looks at somebody else and say, oh yeah, I was going to open a place. Yeah. I was going to leave BU and open my own place, but I didn't. I stayed here. I took kind of the safe route and took my little raise every year and stayed there. And now what you realize is a lot of those guys, unfortunately, are very much at the mercy of those universities. And sadly, a lot of people like me are getting phased out. You're too young to remember the reference I'm going to make, but there's a great movie. Oh my God. It's not Holiday Inn. It's a Bing Crosby movie, but it's about the general has to open an inn in Vermont after the war. And there's a song in there, you know, what do you do with a general when he stops being a general? And it's like, what happens to these people when there's no longer any use for you? Mm-hmm. It's White Christmas. Sorry. I can't believe I blanked on White Christmas, like my favorite Christmas movie. But when you realize, okay, you've gotten to that point where you're the old strength coach at the school and you're making a lot of money, and they think, great, I can get a 30-year-old guy to come in, you know, and bring the juice. Right. I'll bring in some guy who'll wear a tight shirt and jump around like a fool and hold my football coach by his belt and keep him off the field and do all the things that strength coaches do, right? They yell, they scream, they dance, they hold people off the sidelines. But no one in administration has any idea. They couldn't tell a good strength coach from a bad strength coach if you lined them all up. And our profession is suffering from that right now, where there are people getting pushed out probably prematurely. And they're not. Bob Alejo had a great line one time. He said, hey, have you ever been to a retirement party for a strength coach? And I said, no. He goes, that's because they don't have any. And that's probably true. More people are sort of just kind of pushed to the side, and some young guy brought in, and then that guy's left thinking, wow, I gave this school or team or whatever it was 20 really good years. And now I'm trying to figure out how I make it to 65. How do I get to the point where I can collect Social Security? Or how do I get to the point where I can start to access my retirement? So one thing I would give people advice about is plan better. Mm-hmm. Plan for the idea that you may be obsolete a little bit before you think you're going to, and that suddenly at 50 or at 55, someone may decide it's time for you to move on, and you need to be prepared for that. You need to think about, okay, what am I going to be doing when I'm 50 or 55 if I'm no longer useful? Luckily, some people, Bob has been a really good example, Alejo, because he's moved into an assistant athletic director role and is now in charge of strength and conditioning, I think, and athletic training in some areas. And hopefully there'll be more of that, where people will advance experienced strength and conditioning coaches into administrative roles where they can then oversee departments. But there's not enough of that either in athletic administration. So a lot of times you end up odd man out.
Part of being an early adopter, is there a little higher risk reward ratio? Have there been mistakes that you have made that you wish you could go back and change in trying to be the first or one of the first to something?
The good thing is not very many for me. I've been pretty good at forecasting. So I'd love to sit here and say, yeah, wow, I shouldn't have done that. In some ways, I said, opening my own business. for a long time, I would say for at least 10 years, I remember thinking, oh my God, everybody was right. Everybody who said stay at BU was right. I should have just stayed at BU because I stayed part-time and still worked with hockey. So I still had sort of some of the financial benefits and I had some of the things that you would get from a college job. But there was a lot of times, I think, when I regretted going into the private sector. But now I look at it and think, wow, you take 20, we're 25 years in, and now we've got a very stable, very mature business that supports myself and my partner really well. And fact of the matter is, I don't need to work anymore. I work because I like to, I work because I enjoy it, but I could stop tomorrow and be perfectly fine. I have enough money saved. Everything is set up in such a way that my life is very, very stable without work. So I think that's part of it too, is you may look at things at some point, much like I think anybody does when you're struggling to build any type of business. But if you struggle through the first 20 years at a college and then you get to year 20, you realize that you don't have anything, that no one's going to sort of come in and pat you on the back and give you a gold watch and say, wow, great. I would encourage people, again, at Boston University, there were no pensions. It was strictly 401k. Whatever you saved, you got when you left, but you're not in a situation, say, where you were a municipal employee and you can think, all right, now I have a pension and I'm going to get X amount of dollars for the rest of my life. So I think the biggest thing goes back to that idea of planning. And I've been trying to get a lot of the young kids that work for me. It's like, buy a house, ideally buy a multifamily house, buy, and I don't know every state, but in Massachusetts, you can buy up to 4 units as a first-time home buyer with between 3% and 5% down. That's the one you get, a once in a, literally, it's like a lottery, once in a lifetime opportunity. Is someone going to say to you, I'm going to let you buy a really expensive asset with a really low down payment, and I'm going to actually help you to do that. And yet what people will do instead is they'll go out and have the white picket fence dream where they'll go into the suburbs and buy a house they can't afford for more money than they can afford and basically strap themselves with an unaffordable mortgage for the rest of their life. And then they'll go and get a car payment and have an unaffordable car payment. And they'll sort of create the same trap for themselves that every kind of middle-class person creates, where they just spend the rest of their life keeping up with the Joneses. And suddenly their kids are 20 and they're thinking, or 18. And how do I pay for this kid to go to college? Okay, I'll have to remortgage this house that I just paid off. It's a really bad process. And I think becoming financially literate when you're young is really important. I was lucky in the sense that, again, early adopter, I read a book called How to Become Financially Successful by Investing in Real Estate, probably in my very early 20s. And I bought a 2-family house in my early 20s in a bad neighborhood where people told me not to buy it. And I resold it and made a lot of money. And I bought 2 more houses with the money that I made from that one. And my wife and I lived in the studio apartment on the 3rd floor of one of those 3-family houses. And we fixed up the other 2 apartments and we rented them out. We did a lot of things right early on from an investment standpoint. And now at whatever, 60, almost 2 in a couple of weeks, I'm very much reaping the benefit of all that.
Do you feel a need to talk to your interns about financial literacy, even though they're not there for that?
Yep. I feel a need to talk to everybody about financial literacy, even though they're not there for that, because you realize, I think it's being financially illiterate is probably one of the great failings of our educational system, where you get kids who don't even understand mortgages and interest rates and compound interest. I always recommend, if you think like Darren Hardy's, whatever, I can't think of the name of his book, but Slight Edge, Jeff Olson's book, Slight Edge, and Darren Hardy's book are almost the same book, but they talk about the idea of compound interest. And I recommend books like The Wealthy Barber and Richest Man in Babylon and things like that. Hey, read these basic financial literacy books, you know, read Millionaire Next Door. Like, I'm the classic Millionaire Next Door. When you read the Millionaire Next Door, you realize they live in a modest house. They drive an average car. You'd look at the person and think, I wouldn't think that person was wealthy. I think some people would look at me most of the time and think, I mean, maybe I'm not a bum, but I'm certainly not financially stable, because I 90% of the time I have on shorts and a sweatshirt and I probably look like a bum. I don't shave all the time. Yet we're in a situation where we own four businesses, we own three houses. We're very financially stable going into, my wife is younger. She's 55, I'm 62, but we did everything right growing up. And as a result, we're in a really good position where we're not thinking about how are we going to pay for our kids to go to college? What are we going to do for retirement? Are we even, some people, are we going to be able to retire? How, you know, when will I have to work till? I think that's a terrible thought when people think, when will I have to work till? But people, young people, don't think about these things enough.
I absolutely agree. And it's really easy early on in your career to focus on, oh, like what training philosophy, what, like you said, like the name on the jersey, the rings, all of that. But at some point you start thinking about how am I going to retire? When do I want to retire? And I definitely didn't have this in my notes here, but I'm glad this got brought up because I don't think it gets talked often enough. And especially,
I'll give you the perfect example. I have very early on in my career, just strangely, I always think things work. They always say, you know, the world works in mysterious ways. A guy walked into my gym at Boston University, probably again, it would have been 1997, 1998. And he said, I'm an Olympic weightlifter and I'm looking for a place with platforms where I can Olympic weightlift. And I would say that I had turned down everyone previously that had ever walked into my weight room with any kind of pitch like that. Sorry, we don't allow outsiders in. For whatever reason, I took an immediate liking to this guy. I was like, yeah, you know, if you come in after work, you can grab a platform as long as you know that if we get busy, you have to get out of the way. And I let him come in an Olympic weightlift, and it turned out he was in the money business, financial business. He was a broker for Bear Stearns and, again, was pretty well off. I didn't know that at the time, but I started to realize as I hung around with him that he was doing okay. But he, one thing he said to me, we used to talk about the idea of investing and saving money. And I was, you know, again, so 97, say 25 years ago, in my late 30s. And he said to me, Mike, you won't understand money or investing until you hit critical mass. And I remember thinking like, what do you mean? Like, what's critical mass? And he said, you know, he was like, how much money do you have saved? And I remember thinking, I probably looked at him and said, I think I got $40,000 saved. And he said, yeah. So if in 7 years, your $40,000 turns into $80,000, he said, that's not a really big event. He said, when you have $1 million and in 7 years, that money turns into $2 million. He said, that's a really big event. He said, and it's, I remember him saying something like, it's the last couple turns of the wheel that really matter. And again, I don't think I ever comprehended what he said. And then I remember at one point looking at my wife and thinking, we're rich. He's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, the last couple turns of the wheel have been really significant suddenly, you know, now I said at 62. So imagine at 50, I'm thinking, okay, I got, you know, let's just take a round. I got 500,000 at 50. Suddenly at 57, I'm thinking, shit, I got $1 million in the bank. And then I'm looking at, you know, 64 and I'm thinking, wow, at 64, I'm going to have $2 million in the bank. Like those last couple of times that money doubles, the last couple times that compound interest works for you, become amazingly significant in the end of your career. And nobody realizes this. They don't think about it. Again, they don't read Slight Edge. They don't read, I wish I could think of the Darren Hardy book, but I can't think of the name of it right now. But either one of those books will get people understanding, wow, I should start saving right now. And even for me, you know, I remember I drove the shittiest. I had a Toyota pickup truck. I drove it till, I mean, it was rusted out. And then I lucked out because one of my athletes, Cam Neely, who's now the president of the Bruins, won what they call the seventh player award, which is like the kind of the unsung hero, which he never should have won because he was the best player on the team, but he had been injured and then come back, didn't play in all the games. So he ends up winning the seventh player award. The winner of the seventh player award gets a car. And I remember him. I had just gone and agreed to buy a new car because the Bruins guys, when I was working, because I was working part-time for the Bruins during the 90s while I worked at BU. But guys would always give me shit about my car because it was all rusted out. And I'd gone and I had filled out all the paperwork to buy another pickup truck because I had one of those old Toyota pickups. And I told Cam that. I said, yeah, I'm trading in the pickup truck. And he's like, you can't. I'm like, what do you mean you can't? He's like, I'm giving you the car from the seventh player award. And I was like, I already signed the papers. He's like, you got to go back. You got to drive back to the dealership. And he said, explain to them, tell them the whole story. Tell them Cam Neely just won the seventh player award and gave me a car. I don't need this car anymore. And I did. I went back to the dealership and I said, the guy was so excited for me. He said, that's unbelievable. And he like tore up the paperwork, threw it away.
Wow.
And I ended up getting, what I did is I traded in the car that he won. I got the value of the car towards the pickup truck that I wanted. But that was the first, I think that was the first really new car that I'd ever had. And now I think this is 1995 or six. I'm working at BU. I'm working for the Bruins, but I'm still driving a beat up pickup truck. I hadn't gone out and spent, I hadn't put myself in debt to get those types of things.
I really like that critical mass theory because it applies to like a coaching career as well. You have to start off with an unpaid internship. And you can argue if that's good or bad or indifferent. But if you just keep putting in the work, keep putting in the value, keep getting good experience, at some point, it's going to get exponential. And when you put enough time in, you're going to see those massive returns. And I think for my generation, it's really hard to do that because there's so much comparison on social media of what other people have and what you don't have. So I really like that theory because it applies to finance, but I think it applies very well to the sports performance field as a young coach, working your way through the ranks to getting to where you want to go.
Absolutely. I think, as I said, that the people that came and worked with me were doing unpaid volunteer experiences just to learn. And the payoff for them down the road was, again, as you said, exponential. The jobs that they got based on the experience that they had was a huge difference. I mean, that we get into the argument all the time about the unpaid internship thing. And I don't think when you're exchanging knowledge that it is in fact unpaid. I think there's a huge value to knowledge that exceeds the minimum wage. And I know for me, I never thought about what I was going to make when I was gaining an experience, because I knew I had gone there for the experience. And I think if I'd gone there for the money at that time, again, when I was younger, I was a bartender. That's where I was making most of my money because I was either volunteering or working part-time in strength and conditioning. And I always thought I could go work another bar shift and make a lot more money than I would make if I tried to get this person to pay me some measly amount for the amount of hours that I was going to go work for them. And again, I think you hate to say it, but it is the ability to hustle. It is. I think it makes me sound old school. It makes me sound cliche, but I want those people around who are willing to work a second job, willing to work on the weekends. Because I've had so many of those guys that have worked with me and for me who've gone on to do amazing things. And most of them went on to do amazing things because they were not afraid of work. And I think about Mike Potenza parking cars in Florida while he's doing his internship at International Performance Institute, or going home on the weekends to work. Brajesh Patel used to go home every weekend to work for his parents' catering company. And he would work for us probably 60 hours a week during the week at Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning. He'd immediately get his car and drive back to Connecticut to work with his parents all weekend. And then he'd get done at the end of work with his parents all weekend, and he'd drive back and work 60 hours a weekend. Brajesh never complained once. He never whined about, oh, I'm not getting paid for my internship, or this isn't going to work out. And then when I still remember, he's still at Quinnipiac. The Quinnipiac AD called me and said, I need a strength coach. I said, I got the perfect guy for you. And Brajesh has been there for, I don't even know how many years, but it's been a really long time, probably 15 years that he's been there. But again, he's found a situation that works really well for him. Great teams, great coaches, great family life, all the things that you probably should really be looking for in this situation.
There's nothing special about working that second job, but it seems like it's a predictor of future success. And that's what we're looking for. Like when you're a coach trying to hire an intern, or you're trying to find peers that you want to be around, it's like, what are these predictors of future success? And if they're putting in that extra work, also, like you mentioned, putting in the extra work without complaining. There's so many people who work more, but then they just complain more about it. And it's like, if you don't want to work more, or if you don't like it, like, don't do more then. Like, that's up to you. It's about your mindset. It's about your situation, finding that right fit. And it seems like you've done that throughout your career, both for yourself and for so many coaches. I don't know if you truly understand the impact you've made on the strength and conditioning world. Almost every coach I have on here brings up your name at some point. And maybe I'm biased and just pick people because I like you and I like your philosophies. And maybe I just pick too many people who like those as well. But I just really appreciate everything you've done for the strength and conditioning community. And thanks for jumping on the podcast again, Mike. I appreciate it.